about cheating on her husband for 4.5 years while still living under his roof. Margaret Josephs. They had a fucking hemorrhage. My daughter was very upset that I shared any of it. Very devastated. But it was my story. I was telling them how I felt about mistakes I made. It was about my heartbreak. One of the biggest feuds of the season was between newcomer Margaret and Siggy. Margaret Josephs. I knew Siggy, but I was not friends with her. Believe me, I could not stomach her at all before I got on the show. Siggy Flicker. She's not my type of girl, and I'm not hers. I would never hang out with somebody like that. We have an organic dislike. Margaret Josephs. She made my life fucking miserable from day one. She was a total fucking douche. She was unhinged. Siggy Flicker. From scene number one, when Margaret Josephs said she put pot on her pussy, I was already grossed out. Then she talked about her mom swallowing and talked about cheating on her husband. I was done. I said, this is not my type of girl. Dolores Catania. Siggy felt the producers were closer with Margaret, which they were. Margaret knew what to do to stay on the show. She went for Siggy. She called her soggy. Margaret Josephs. They loved it. As soon as I said it, everybody started cracking up. Dolores Catania. Siggy looked at her like, what'd you just do to me? Like she had shot her. That was the beginning of the end. Siggy never got over that moment. Margaret Josephs. I was encouraged to apologize to her. I was like, grow the fuck up. But everyone was like, she's hurt. I'm not used to people like that. She was crying. She took it to heart. She still cannot dial it back. Housewives is not for the faint of heart, the overly sensitive, and first-class pussies. You have to be able to move on. Dolores Catania. Siggy went out of her fucking mind. Margaret Josephs. From then on, shooting with her was horrible. Noah Sampton. Siggy is a very emotional, sensitive person. Siggy Flicker. All I have to say is, thank the Lord for Dolores Catania. She stood by me. Even Teresa called me and said, Siggy, I see what's going on. I love you. Hang in there. It was so hard. Teresa Giudice and Dolores Catania saved me from not walking off the show. Noah Sampton. It was complete torture. When I saw Margaret or Siggy calling or emailing me, I would cringe because there were two people at complete odds. The number of phone calls I had from both of them, the issues they had with each other, who did what and how upset they were, it was absolutely awful. There was no middle ground. It went on for months. Trouble between the two women built up all season, culminating in a major blow-up and accusations of anti-Semitism. Siggy Flicker. It started because I said, I'm going to so-and-so's charity event. Margaret right away says, I don't like them. I said, but you don't know them. You've never met them. They happen to be an angel and a doll, so shut up. And then she says, Hitler wouldn't have killed me. Does that make him a great person? Now, if somebody would have brought up the KKK to a woman of color on Housewives of Atlanta, that would be meant to hurt them. This was an anti-Semitic remark, and it was meant to hurt me. I know plenty of self-hating Jews. She said that to hurt me. When you're not getting along with somebody and you claim you want to make up with them, you apologize. You're not going to bring up Hitler's name, knowing I'm the daughter of a Holocaust survivor and scholar and the only Jew in the room. Why was Hitler even on her brain? Margaret Josephs. Her big thing is that she judges people only by the way they treat her. I said, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I tried to explain it to her 27 different ways, and I said, Siggy, that's like saying Hitler would have been good to me, but that doesn't make him a good person. That's not anti-Semitic. But you know, she has a fucking pea brain. Then she said I was anti-Semitic, knowing well and good that I was married to someone Jewish previously, that my son had a bar mitzvah, that I raised Jewish children. Dolores Catania. Siggy wanted it to become something, and it didn't. And that drove her crazy because, once again, she wasn't vindicated for something. It bothered her. Margaret Josephs. Teresa felt sorry for Siggy. Dolores felt loyal to Siggy. It did divide the cast. Siggy was so crazy. After she called me an anti-Semite, it really put a rift in the whole thing. Lucilla D'Agostino. It was not good for anyone. It wasn't good for the show, it wasn't good for Siggy, and it certainly wasn't good for Margaret. All of the hurt and all of the accusations were truly inflammatory. For Margaret, to be called an anti-Semite is very powerful, very painful, and it wasn't done for a television show. That's really how it got between them. Margaret Josephs. I knew they were going to put it on there. I don't think I ever asked them not to air it. I just said, I'm so devastated. I'm so upset. They were like, obviously we know you're not anti-Semitic. Basically, I was like, I can't work with someone like this. She has to fix this. But she was trying to push me off the show. Little did she know, it backfired. Everybody who was Jewish came to my defense. Noah Sampton. It didn't have to blow up like that. We didn't want them to hate each other, but there was no stopping it. Siggy Flicker. They really had high hopes for her, but she fell short. You don't have any girl out there saying, when I grow up, I want to be Margaret Josephs. Come on, she's a joke. She's a clown. That Margaret Josephs was always very, very jealous of me. In the end, season 8 would be Siggy's last. Noah Sampton. She was just done. She was not having fun, and she didn't feel supported by the people she thought were her friends. And they were having a hard time understanding what she was so bothered by. There was no way to come back from it all. Lucilla D'Agostino. If we're going to say Jacqueline would get obsessive behind the scenes, I feel like Siggy would have been second in line to claim that title. Behind the scenes, the show really upset her. Andy Cohen. Her relationship with the show and the producers turned really toxic. How many times can you relitigate that cake? Melissa Gorga. You have to have a thick skin. Siggy and Jacqueline were great housewives and they made great stories, but they personally could not handle it. Andy Cohen. The viewer is kind of turned on Siggy. There is love to hate and there's hate to hate. And unfortunately, as that season went on, people were just very annoyed. Siggy Flicker. I really went in there with all the best intentions, and I have to say, it was like Mean Girls. Every day, they took that knife and they stuck it in deeper and deeper. I used to call the Bravo executives all the time and report the producers, and they knew it. I would call them out, which would infuriate them. It became draining for me, and after about episode 6, I no longer wanted to be there. It took the life out of me. Now, Bravo was nothing but amazing to me. Andy Cohen was nothing but a gentleman to me. At the end, I had to just write the resignation letter, give it to my attorney, and say, for the sake of my health, I can't do it. It was just too much for me. Margaret Josephs. I didn't really know Andy, but I knew he sided with me. Andy Cohen. Siggy was very upset at Margaret for mentioning Hitler's name in an analogy. Side note, analogies never work on Jersey. I mean, listen, I'm Jewish. I talked to my rabbi about it. I talked to my parents about it. No one I know who's Jewish had a problem with using Hitler as an analogy. But she did, and now it became a huge thing. Margaret Josephs. She claims they let her walk away, but they were going to not ask her back. It was very clear. She couldn't take me being happy. She just felt I was favored or I was treated better. Meanwhile, I wasn't. She just did crazy, crazy things. But when she left, I felt like I hit the lottery. Like I hit the fucking lottery. Siggy Flicker. I just know that in the 2 seasons I was on Housewives of New Jersey, I made my mark. The thing that I'm most proud of is leaving the show when I did. That was the best. My whole life, I was always about know your worth. And when you're not being treated correctly, you walk away. As Siggy departed, 2 new castmates joined the gang. Meet Jackie Goldschneider and Jennifer Aiden. Jackie Goldschneider, housewife. They reached out to me on Facebook. And at first I said, I'm sorry, I'm really not interested. That night I went home, took a screenshot of the text, wrote LOL on the bottom, and sent it to my 3 best college friends. All of a sudden, they started texting me going, are you nuts? Call her back right now. Tell her you want to do this. Then I sent it to my mother and she was like, you don't say no until you know what it is. Lucilla D'Agostino. Jackie came from a whole other life experience. Jackie Goldschneider. Evan and I live around the corner from Siggy Flicker. We would drive by her house, see the vans outside, and say to each other, I don't know what kind of person would do a reality show. Like, who would want all these cameras in their face all the time? The whole world knowing their business? Andy Cohen. We loved that she had been a lawyer. She was professional, but she still seemed Jersey, very ballsy and unafraid of anybody. Jackie Goldschneider. I texted Siggy the same night I texted my friends. I said, Bravo Casting reached out to me. Should I go for it? She wrote back and she just said, it's the worst thing I've ever done in my life. I did it only to sell books, and I sold books. And then I got the hell out of there. It was horrendous. And you put your life in the hands of editors. That's all I have to say about it. Good luck. Still, at that point, I thought the chances I'd get it would be 1 in 1,000. So I called the casting producer back, and we just went from there. Sherry Levine. Jennifer was perfect for New Jersey. She came from an old-world, traditional family dynamic. She still had family in the old country. It was a different culture, but felt very in line with the old-world Italian culture that was at the heart of New Jersey. She and Teresa and Dolores understood each other in a very core way. Jennifer Aiden, housewife. I had originally applied in season 6, but I was instructed that Bravo was on the prowl for a group connected through a family member or neighbor or something. So I pitched my cousin who lived in Franklin Lakes. Noah Sampton. By season 9, we were looking for a reinvigoration for Jersey. We wanted something that would breathe new life into it. Jennifer and Jackie both felt different from anything we had seen before. And Jennifer knew Melissa and Dolores, so they had real relationships. Lucilla D'Agostino. I'm always excited by the prospect of showing people who are exactly what people think Italian-American New Jersey women are like. But Jennifer also brought that Turkish background, this different idea of what families do and how husbands and wives behave. It was fun to explore her role in her family. Andy Cohen. Jennifer seemed like a Jersey housewife from the get-go, a plastic surgeon's wife, big McMansion, and she loved to flaunt it. Jennifer Aiden. Of course, the vanity got the best of me, and I decided to interview so I could say no to them after what had happened before. Noah Sampton. I went out to her house, and it's this amazing sort of excess. Jennifer Aiden. My house is a castle like the Taj Mahal. I pinch myself every day. Andy Cohen. When Margaret talked about how close the mansion is to the Paramus Mall, I mean, it's so funny. Noah Sampton. It was visually overwhelming. Her house is giant, with this huge pool and a basketball court and a movie theater. She's got 5 kids and 2 maids and an intercom system. But she would be on the intercom calling for help, and it was like being on the New York City subway in the 70s. You couldn't understand a word. She had a lot of elements that you look for in a housewife. Excessive glamour, the loud family. Jennifer Aiden. I have the house, I got the husband, I got the kids, I got the crazy extended family. I'm willing to show it all, the good, the bad, the ugly. Of course I would be perfect. So they call me up to tell me I got the gig and that Melissa would introduce me on the show. Boom. Noah Sampton. The thing that cemented Jennifer for me was when she said, let me show you my Siggy impression. And she did a dead-on impression of Siggy. It was perfect. Dolores Catania. I liked her when I met her. She reminded me of Fran Drescher. Lucilla D'Agostino. I also love anybody who has an unabashed love for plastic surgery and is unafraid to talk about it and to call people out on it. Jackie Goldschneider. The first time I walked into Jennifer's house, I was like, oh my God, this house is enormous. And she kept showing off all the shit she had and thinking to myself, bitch, I could buy this house without a mortgage with what I've got in the bank right now. I could buy this and not even notice a dent in my bank account. But I was hiding that. I hid my wealth for 1.5 seasons. I've heard people say it's the first time in the history of housewives somebody wanted to appear poorer than they actually are. But I have a lot of family money. It's not a lot of money that's liquid sitting in my bank account. I invest everything. And I've got tons of real estate. But if I want to go buy something, I can. So when she was bragging about a big empty house in Paramus, and I had to listen to all of this and have to be impressed by it, I didn't like her from day one. I fucking hate people who brag. I fucking hate it because I know I have more than you. So shut your fucking mouth because I'm not impressed by any of it. Dolores Catania. Jen's always trying to prove something. Jackie Goldschneider. She said a few times to me that first season, we always have to stick together. We have to be each other's allies. Lucilla D'Agostino. She likes to call people out on their bullshit. Jackie Goldschneider. It's no secret that I don't like Jen. I'm glad she's there, though, because she throws herself under the bus for the sake of the show. Melissa Gorga. Jennifer is another one of those who would just do whatever she had to do to make herself seen. The season 9 reunion brought a big revelation. One of the staple relationships of the show could be coming to an end, the marriage of Joe and Teresa Giudice. Andy Cohen. I was surprised when Teresa said at the reunion that if Joe got deported, they were splitting up. That was the first we'd heard of it. Rosie Pieri. Come on. She wasn't going to say, I'm moving to Italy. No way. I don't know what their marriage was like. I don't even want to speculate because I didn't live with them. It's not my business. But I always thought if he had to stay in Italy, she wouldn't go there. She wouldn't be able to live there. It's not a life that she could deal with. Teresa Giudice. There were people that wanted to take us down, which they did. I have to say, they did take us down, which is sad. But, you know, we both rose back up. I wish he wouldn't have got deported because it's sad for my children. But I guess this is the way life was supposed to go. I don't know how else to look at it. I can't keep crying over it. Dolores Catania. Those two, they have a special bond. They'll forever be connected because of those girls. Teresa Giudice. Joe was a great husband and is a great father. The way he acted on the show was so different than the way he acted with me in person. The thing was, he didn't like to film and I would make him do it, and then he would be an ass on the show. Believe me, he was horrified by his behavior on the show looking back. He was. I should have just not made him film. You see how some husbands get into it? He didn't like the cameras. He wasn't trying to become famous. He's just a normal person. Season 10 saw an all-returning cast for the first time in years, but that didn't mean it was short on drama. One unexpected showdown stemmed from a pair of 12-year-olds' birthday party. Jackie Goldschneider. Producers asked me, are you going to throw your kids a party? When I think of housewives' parties, I think of Taylor Armstrong throwing that party for Kennedy in the first season of RHOBH. I told them, I do not do over-the-top birthday parties for my children, so I'm going to show you the real party I would have. Jennifer Aiden. Number one thing at a birthday party is entertainment. All right, we've got 20 kids here. Now, what are we going to do? We're going to sit here and twiddle our thumbs? Run around in circles? No, pick a team, kids. Basketball, blue or white. I had a 6-year-old wearing fucking heels. You think she wants to play on the white team of the basketball game? I don't think so, honey. Where's your gender-friendly activity table? Jackie Goldschneider. When you're 12 years old, it's a fucking drop-off party. I'm not going to have food for adults at a drop-off party. Jennifer Aiden. When you're inviting adults, it's common courtesy to have a little bit of something other than just pizza and cake. There wasn't even a fucking balloon in sight. Jackie Goldschneider. Jennifer said it was sweltering heat and that everyone had to stand in a driveway. It was a beautiful April day, but it certainly wasn't sweltering heat. It was 65 degrees. I was in a fucking turtleneck. Jennifer Aiden. And then the Amazon box came. Jackie Goldschneider. The thing with the Amazon box is like me at my core. Me throwing that Amazon box on the floor, I didn't think, this is such a great filming moment. I just put it down because I didn't want the kids to leave without their party favor. People went to town on it. People fucking loved it. Every mom in America fucking loved it. Jennifer Aiden. The fact that it was called the goodie bag was actually an oxymoron because there was no bag inside, honey. Jackie Goldschneider. The people who are fancy schmancies thought, how could you do that? You ruined the party. People still talk about it. Jennifer Aiden. At the end of the day, I just felt she was being stingy. Jackie Goldschneider. I am the least cheap person in the world, but I don't spend money on nonsense. I don't see any point in it. In what can only be described as a full circle moment, the most dramatic showdown of the season involved Danielle and a hair pull. But this time, Danielle wasn't on the receiving end. Margaret Josephs.
When I first joined the show, I wanted to give Danielle a fair shot. I figured years had gone by. Maybe she was better. She probably had therapy. I thought she was misunderstood. If you look at her first season, she was very sweet, very nurturing. I liked her. We spent a lot of time together, and I really wanted her to be a housewife. I truly wanted good things for her.
Danielle Staub.
I allowed her to get in and know my damages while she was sharing all of hers.
Margaret Josephs.
Everything I did, she wanted to do and do it better. She moved to Englewood, New Jersey to be by me. She shopped in the same boutiques, used the same hairdresser. She was very single white female. I know it sounds crazy, but I was getting pissed off at her. She would say that I talk crap about her and about my friends. One day she said to me, crying, I don't know who to trust. I said, don't trust anybody. You talk too much. I said that because she tells everything to everybody all the time.
Melissa Gorga. Margaret was not happy with a lot of the things Danielle was saying and doing. She wasn't happy with the friend that she was, and she didn't want to be a part of it anymore.
Jackie Goldschneider.
Once Danielle started fighting with Margaret, it all went downhill. She thought I took Margaret from her. I didn't have to take Margaret from anyone. Margaret has more friends than I've ever had in my life. Margaret is her own person.
The bad blood escalated during a shopping trip gone terribly wrong. After an exchange of harsh words on both sides, Margaret dumped a bottle of water out on Danielle. In retaliation, Danielle threw the contents of Margaret's purse on a candle. Just after things had seemingly died down, Danielle came back for more, yanking Margaret's ponytail.
Margaret Josephs.
We were arguing for probably an hour and a half to 2 hours. She was acting crazy. She pushed me twice.
Noah Sampton.
Margaret poured the water on Danielle.
Margaret Josephs.
I did think she was going to hit me. That's a housewife move. Instead, she set my purse on fire. She did. She ruined the stuff. She burnt my Valentino bag, my makeup, my money, my lipstick. All that stuff was smushed into that candle. Everything. She poured wax into my bag.
Jennifer Aiden. Let's put ourselves in that situation. Would we let someone pour water over us in an aggressive and hostile manner, especially on camera when they're going to make us look like a punk in front of the whole world? Hell fucking no! That is a sign of attack. An attack deserves retaliation.
Noah Sampton.
Danielle sort of thought about it for a few minutes. She didn't react immediately, but she was not going to let Margaret get away with that.
Jennifer Aiden.
Danielle could have played that scene any way she wanted. Maybe she could have gotten the pity card and Margaret would have looked like the villain. Instead, the way she retaliated was so aggressive that nobody cared what Margaret did anymore. You pulled her hair. You risked physically harming her. That's not what we signed up for.
Margaret Josephs.
Dolores, Melissa, Jackie, and I were talking about how crazy Danielle is because she set my purse on fire. We were cleaning it up. I had no idea she was coming back over to me because I was bent over. We were all so taken aback. I didn't even know what was happening.
Noah Sampton.
There are many people in the world who will say, if you pour a glass of water on somebody's head, get ready to get punched in the face. And then there are people who will say pouring a glass of water on somebody's head is not something you should do, but it certainly doesn't justify physical assault. And I'm sure if you ask 50 people, You're going to get a lot of different opinions on which is right. But believe me, Margaret thinks very strongly that there is a vast gulf between pouring water on somebody's head and pulling somebody's hair. And Danielle thinks one action leads to a reaction. So that was what we were in the middle of. Jennifer Aiden. Danielle claims to be a pro on this show. If you're so much of a pro, don't do it on fucking camera. You want to win this game? Hold your own. Keep it together. Walk out like a lady. Noah Sampton. Dealing with the immediate aftermath, Margaret was incredibly upset, understandably, at what had happened. She wanted to be done shooting the show. She didn't want Danielle to ever be on the show again because of this. Jennifer Aiden. I told Teresa it was fucked up that Danielle pulled Margaret's hair. I didn't know Teresa was in on it. None of us knew. We all found out at the finale. That was very, very real. Noah Sampton. We didn't find out about that until days after the incident, when one of the audio guys came to the producers of the show and said, "Hey, Teresa said something to Danielle before she pulled Margaret's hair." That sort of shifted the entire story for us, because suddenly we now had this whole other layer that Teresa was actually the instigator. Teresa Giudice.
It wasn't my idea. Steven Dan, the owner of the shop we were in, he's the one who said it first, and then she came up to me and asked me. I wasn't in the right state of mind because I was drinking, so I said, yeah. What I didn't know then was that it was on camera. Like, Danielle was trying to be discreetful. But they caught her, and I was mic'd when she came and asked me in my ear.
Noah Sampton. Margaret thought Teresa was her good friend, not knowing that her good friend betrayed her this way. As producers, that was important information for Margaret to have. It was challenging for us because we didn't like that Margaret was sort of living a lie and was unaware of Teresa's role in what happened to her. But at the same time, we didn't want to engineer what happened. So it remained a secret until Danielle brought it up on her own to Melissa, and Melissa brought it back to Margaret. Jennifer Aiden.
Danielle ratted Teresa out. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. You don't burn the bridge that crosses you over to the other side. What is she, an idiot? Teresa was her only anchor to this group.
Noah Sampton. There were layers to what was going on. Danielle was being dumped on by everybody. There was talk of her getting kicked off the show because she was being violent. And Danielle was telling us on the side that Teresa encouraged her. She was trying to defend herself.
Margaret Josephs.
When I found out, I was in shock. Why would Teresa do this? I was like, what is going on here? How did they plot it? What happened?
Noah Sampton.
Teresa thought she had gotten away with it. Then suddenly, the conversation came up. I'm sure she felt like, oh, now I'm in trouble for something I thought I'd gotten away with. And you know, she wasn't happy about it.
Teresa Giudice.
When Melissa told me what Danielle had said, I got upset with production and cursed them out because I realized at that moment they had that footage.
Melissa Gorga.
Deep down, Teresa was probably making Danielle do it for the show. And now production was calling her out. She was pissed.
Jennifer Aiden.
Well, Teresa saw that Margaret did pick on Danielle. Yes, Danielle was an easy target. But when Margaret goes in, she goes in hard. There are times when Danielle doesn't go in, and Danielle looks like the punk. So Teresa was a little fed up.
Noah Sampton.
I don't think Teresa really meant to encourage violence.
Jennifer Aiden.
If someone poured water on Teresa like that, can you imagine what Teresa would have done? She would have been like a jungle animal, like straight for the throat.
Teresa Giudice.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody treated me like we were great friends and you did what you did to me that day, it was bad. But at the end of the day, Danielle's her own person. You don't have to listen to me. You know what I mean? Like, do your own thing.
Margaret Josephs.
In Teresa's head, she probably thought Danielle was going to come and give me a little yank on my ponytail, you know? Teresa doesn't think things through.
Teresa Giudice.
I got blamed for it, but I really was apologetic. I apologized to Margaret.
Margaret Josephs.
Teresa truly cares about me. She knows I've been good to her.
She was mortified when she thought about it. I just think that can't be an excuse anymore. She has to take accountability moving forward.
Teresa Giudice. I'm not like Jackie Goldschneider, who, like, starts crying, you know?
Jackie Goldschneider. Margaret was absolutely adamant that if Danielle was ever in one scene with her again, that she would never come back to the show. So I knew that if Danielle wasn't coming around Margaret, she probably wasn't coming around me anymore. Once you put your hands on somebody, you throw yourself off the show. I hate her, but I wouldn't mind filming with her because I could fucking tear her apart.
Margaret Josephs.
Listen, I didn't blow it up. I could have made a big stink, but I was like, I'm not even gonna. I was so disgusted. She attacked me. She was trying to say I poured the water. I pushed her. I was like, cut me a fucking break.
Noah Samden. What ultimately happened was that Danielle wanted things to unfold in a way that worked for her. And Margaret wanted Danielle to be done forever at that moment. And neither one of them was getting exactly what they wanted. To Margaret's credit, she ultimately rolled with some punches because she understood that having Danielle on the show in some capacity is something the viewers wanted to see. They wanted to see resolution after that hair pull. In the end, season 10 was Danielle's swan song. Noah Sampton. There was nobody on the show who was friends with her by the end of the season. There was nowhere for her to go on the show. You cannot be on Housewives and not be friends with anybody else in the cast. It just doesn't work. So it's not as simple as Margaret got her fired or Danielle quit. There's a lot of gray area in there. Andy Cohen. At Danielle's request, she came on WWHL and announced that she was quitting the show to focus on her YouTube cooking show and that she would never, ever come back. That was the last I saw of her. A year or so later, she put out a podcast completely trashing me as a human being and a father.
Teresa Giudice. She made a mistake because instead of going after Melissa, who kind of wrote her off back in season 3, Danielle went against me when I'm the one who brought her back on the show. I'm the one that got her a paycheck again. And then she's the one who threw me under the bus. I was like, really? Why would you do that? Now you don't have a job anymore. I couldn't believe that. Talk about loyalty.
Margaret Josephs.
Danielle's entire life was Housewives of New Jersey. Obsessed. Her only goal in life was to get back on and prove herself. And she proved herself to be exactly what she was, a psychopath.
Dolores Catania. The thing about New Jersey wives, everybody had their part in how their story ended. No one can make you do anything. They can't make you look like you're doing something that you didn't do. The producers aren't photoshopping you on the floor under the table drunk. You're doing it. You've done this. You have to own it.
Teresa Giudice.
Everyone thinks I'm not smart. Believe me, I'm smarter than everyone thinks. I may play that role, but trust me, I'm not going to go down that way. I know how to make good TV. If you come at me, I'm coming guns blazing.
Part 5. Capital Wives. The Real Housewives of D.C. Premiere date, August 5th, 2010. Finale date, October 21st, 2010. When the FBI subpoenas your raw tapes, you're not bringing the show back. Andy Cohen. The D.C. franchise of Real Housewives lasted only one season, but it certainly made headlines. That's mostly thanks to cast members Mikhail and Tariq Salahi, the now infamous White House party crashers, who may or may not have had an invitation to the White House state dinner they attended. Lauren Zelaznik. DC was a great example of flying in the face of every critic who said it's produced reality, it's manipulated, it's controlled, it's this and that. Well, first of all, the show was interesting because it was very hard to cast in DC. The people are interesting, but it's such a tight little society. It was a pretty good season, and it was going fine. And then, honestly, we got grifted, and we were stunned. Stunned. As was our crew when the grifters actually grifted their way into a very exclusive event. Andy Cohen. I was really proud of RHODC. It was a racially diverse, eclectic group who discussed politics and where access to power meant everything. That access, or attempt at access, is what ultimately sunk the show. Amy Argetsinger, writer, The Washington Post's Reliable Source column. Let me set the stage for you. It was the first state dinner for the Obama White House. It was a big deal. Roxanne Roberts, writer, The Washington Post's Reliable Source column. The first state dinner of any administration is an important social and political moment. That the Obamas, arguably the most popular presidential couple in decades, were finally having their first state dinner almost a year after the election meant that anybody who was anybody within the Democratic political establishment wanted to attend. Andy Cohen. The Salahis were real characters. Mikhail was kind of a bubbly space cadet who was longing to be a society lady. She was zany, untrustworthy, likable, and fragile all at once. Tarek reminded me of an incredibly litigious used car salesman whose suits needed a good dry cleaning. Still, when they told our producers they were invited to the White House for the state dinner honoring India, no one had reason to question them. One of the first scenes we'd shot with them was a polo match featuring the ambassador from India and a friend of theirs from the State Department. Abby Greensfelder, co-founder, Half Yard Productions. My company was developing the franchise, and to us, what's most interesting about DC is that it's really not about money or fame, but about proximity to power. So we thought the state dinner would be a true access moment for the DC Housewives viewer. It's like the prom on steroids for Washington. We tried to get filming access. We needed permits and approvals, but we never heard back from the White House, which wasn't surprising. I never expected they would allow us to film. Those things are very cornered off. So we decided to just follow them to the point where we couldn't anymore. Andy Cohen. We shot plenty that day. Mikhail trying to figure out how to pin herself into her elegant red sari. Mikhail looking for the invitation that may or may not have existed. Then the two of them climbing into the limo and heading toward 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Amy Argetsinger. My guess is that they walked out of the limo knowing they were being filmed as they walked up to the White House gate. I don't think they expected to get in necessarily. For all I know, they figured they would tell Bravo the next day that they had been at the dinner even though they hadn't. Roxanne Roberts. It was a chilly, rainy night in November, and the White House had invited some 300 guests. So the White House staff and the staff at the various security checkpoints were under a lot of pressure to get a large number of people in the door as quickly as possible. And these are all people who are important to the White House in one way or the other. People who are unaccustomed to standing in lines, much less outside in the cold. Abby Greensfelder. Somebody checked the list and allowed them in. We thought it was all good. Roxanne Roberts. The fact that they got in must have been stunning to them. Lauren Zelaznik. The Salahis were shady as hell. I'm thinking back, like going over the episode, or at least that footage in my mind, thinking, we remember they're in the back of the limo, and the producers are saying, but do you have the invite? Could we see them? Could we see it? We can't go in. We've called. The producers have called to get a permit to shoot, even on the ground, and this and that. They don't have a record of you. They just might have gotten away with it, had it not been for Reliable Source columnist Roxanne Roberts, who had been covering the casting and filming of RHODC for the Washington Post. Roxanne Roberts. I had covered state dinners at that point for 20 years. I was really familiar with the routine. And when Mikhail and Tarek walked in, I took notice. And honestly, if I hadn't been there, it's entirely possible no one would have ever noticed. The Venn diagram of people who had a close awareness of The Real Housewives of D.C., which was still filming and hadn't yet aired, and were also intimately familiar with how state dinners happened, was very, very small. Amy Argetsinger. That night, Roxanne called me and said, "You'll never guess who managed to get into the dinner. Tarek and Mikhail Salahi. Roxanne Roberts. They were announced by the military attaché, and my first thought was, could that be? Is it really them? She was wearing a red sari. He was in a tuxedo. I immediately checked the guest list to see if I had overlooked their names. I hadn't. Amy Argetzinger. When Roxanne told me, my immediate reaction was, they must have crashed, because I knew instantly that no one would have put them on that list. Roxanne's reaction was, I don't think it's possible to crash the state dinner. Roxanne Roberts. The idea that anybody could crash the White House, theoretically one of the most secure places in the entire world, was just stunning to me. Amy Argetzinger. Later that night, I saw all the pictures that the Salahis were posting from inside the reception, and I freaked out. Abby Greensfelder. The moment we discovered something was askew was the next day. The Washington Post publishes a list of the people who attended the state dinner in the paper, and I looked at the list and I was like, that's weird, the Salahis are not on here. But I didn't think much more about it. And then I got a call that was like, there's an issue. Amy Argetzinger. We posted some photos online early that Wednesday morning saying, look who showed up at the state dinner. It took us several more hours to be able to write with some measure of confirmation and legal confidence that these people appeared to have crashed. Roxanne Roberts. The White House had to verify that they were not invited guests. Amy Argetzinger. The White House press office's reaction was, I don't know what you think you saw, but those people were not invited. No one let them in. They were not seated. They were almost denying that these people could possibly have been there. To us, that was confirmation that they had gotten in without an invitation. Roxanne Roberts. No one would have noticed they shouldn't have been there until it was time to sit down, because every table at a state dinner is obsessively considered. And each table has someone who serves as the host and knows where everyone is to be seated. So if you're not supposed to be at a state dinner, you can't just sit down at any table. Even so, they basically had a 90-minute ride before the coach was going to turn back into a pumpkin. Amy Argetzinger. Once we published, it was a front-page story. Andy Cohen. I was on a friend's boat in Indonesia, of all places. And that morning, I got up and on the cover of the New York Post was a photo of the Salahis with the headline, Party Dupers. I was looking at them saying, I think I know them. Well, then I checked my email, which was filled with frantic emails from Bravo. Urgent, urgent. That's when it clicked. I was like, oh my God, this is a housewife. Abby Greensfelder. I called Mikhail and asked what happened. She and Tarek were pretty much like, no big deal. They had that all press is good press attitude. Amy Argetzinger. It was one story after another for more than a month because there were so many pieces here. Who is this couple? How did they get in? What was going on at the White House that people who were not invited were able to get in and shake hands with the president? That was the shocking photo when they went into the receiving line. There were some serious national security questions to be answered. Andy Cohen. The press went after Bravo as hard as they did the couple. Lauren Zelaznik. We really had to fend for ourselves, PR-wise. NBC News was really against us. I remember distinctly. There were a lot of people up on high horses, saying it's the end of civilization again because of this little show. Soon. A federal investigation was launched to try to determine how this alleged security breach had occurred. Andy Cohen. This wasn't just some tabloid media firestorm. It was literally a federal case. Abby Greensfelder. There was a federal investigation, a committee on homeland security hearing, and then a grand jury investigation, which some of our staff testified for. Imagine. Here we were asking some 20-year-old producer, who just happened to be helping with a sheet of paper that day, do you mind going in and testifying in front of the grand jury? Mary Schmidt-Amans, housewife. My understanding is that the authorities right away implicated Bravo and producers. Abby Greensfelder. At first, our take was, it's a Real Housewives franchise. It's not a documentary. It's not news. It's an entertainment program. But when the Secret Service got involved, all of a sudden, the truth became vitally important. Andy Cohen. A massive debate was ignited over the ethics of reality TV, which I found incredibly frustrating and very upsetting. Abby Greensfelder. Being in Washington and having a business here, I had people working for me who were savvy about managing government. Before we even started filming, we made sure we were very buttoned up on the types of procedures we needed to follow. And luckily, as part of our production process, we had very diligent notes and call sheets, so everything was very documented. Andy Cohen. Everything was basically turned over to the investigators. Abby Greensfelder. There was a big focus on making sure that we could both assist any investigations the government would do and make sure that we had the evidence that this was not a TV stunt. Andy Cohen. Because it wasn't. Abby Greensfelder. During our investigation, we combed through footage as evidence. We had footage of the Salahis speaking with the person stationed outside the gate. We didn't really have hearable audio on what that full conversation was, but you hear the security person say they're not on the list, but let them go to the next checkpoint. And remember, we couldn't film them after that point because we didn't have a permit. So any further conversations happened out of earshot from us. We still don't know exactly what was said between the Salahis and the final Secret Service person who let them in, but it was clear it wasn't on us. Amy Argetzinger. No charges ever came out of it on the production end. Mary Schmidt Amons. The Secret Service wound up taking the blame for it all. Amy Argetzinger. Desiree Rogers, the White House social secretary, ended up stepping down from her position. There was some perception that she just wasn't running a tight enough ship. Mary Schmidt Amons. Of course, Tarek and Mikhail got off scot-free. Abby Greensfelder. Tarek and Mikhail remained defiant about their innocence the whole time. To this day, I don't think anybody knows the exact truth of what happened, even those who investigated it. Mary Schmidt Amons. I mean, it was an international incident that was captured and unfolded on reality TV cameras. It's mind-blowing, looking back on it, that the whole thing happened. The Real Housewives of D.C. premiered on August 5th, 2010. Its 11-episode season would be its last, making history as the only franchise to get canceled after just one season. Andy Cohen. When the FBI subpoenas your raw tapes, you're not bringing the show back. Abby Greensfelder. Now that we've officially had a reality show president, Andy Cohen has joked about rebooting The Housewives of D.C. with Kellyanne Conway. Television will always have a role to play in Washington because that world we showed, it's still there, whether we're filming it or not. Part 6. Shine of a Diamond. The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Premiere date, October 4th, 2010.
These bitches are jealous. They really can't be happy for each other. A lot of these women are like, it's my show, I'm the star.
Brandy Glanville. Andy Cohen. I was against it in the beginning. I was like, look, we already have four franchises. How much is too much? Alex Baskin. We pitched the network for a few years on the idea of doing Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, and the network was concerned that RHOBH may be unnecessary and duplicative of RHOC. They sort of said, what's the difference? Kathleen French. You could be doing a show in Orange County and a show on Mars. That's how different Beverly Hills is. Dave Ruppel, executive producer. For me, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills was more akin to Dynasty. I remember telling the crew, we're doing soap operas. We're doing cliffhangers and flashbacks and long pauses. We're watching rich people here. And we should be envious of their lifestyle. but we should also know their lives aren't perfect. Alex Baskin. That's why one of the candidates for season one of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills was none other than Lisa Rinna. Lisa Rinna, housewife.
I went in and made a tape, and they came to the house and filmed a little sizzle reel. Usually when you get to that point, you're on the short list.
Alex Baskin. We thought Rinna was an interesting choice because she was very much a Hollywood type. Sort of the actress-entertainer who was still hanging on and has a famous husband. But at the time, Bravo didn't want actresses on the show because they thought it would take away from the reality. Andy Cohen. Lisa Rinna had been on so many reality shows, it just seemed like a parody. For me, it needed to be about real women. I didn't think we should have an actress, and I didn't think any of them should be famous. A few early entrants into the franchise would set the tone for RHOBH. Stunningly aspirational for viewers, extremely competitive for insiders, Kyle Richards, known as aunt to Paris Hilton and sister to Kathy, and a beloved former child star, was the first to catch the attention of production. Jennifer Redinger. I remember my producer was like, I watched an E! True Hollywood Story on Paris Hilton last night, and it showed Kyle Richards' home. We need to get in touch with her. Kyle has all the glamour and the lifestyle of Beverly Hills, but she's so down-to-earth and relatable as a woman. Alex Baskin. She's somehow sort of completely of L.A., but not totally defined by it. Douglas Ross. And she grew up in Hollywood. Kyle Richards, housewife. I knew Bethany, but I hadn't really paid attention to the series, to be honest. I didn't really get what it was. Andy Cohen. I remember there was a pitch from the Richards sisters going around, centering a show on Kyle, Kim, and Kathy. That brought in Kyle and Kim, and now, of course, we have Kathy, too. So that germ of an idea really blossomed into the show. Kyle Richards. No. What happened was they kind of said they may not do Beverly Hills because of the OC thing, and I'll never forget. I was sitting in the parking lot of Portia's preschool. It was her mommy and me. E had offered us a show with my sisters and me. E had, all three of us. At that time, E wasn't the sister network, so my manager called me. I guess when Bravo heard about the E show, they were like, wait a minute, hold on, we're going to lose these girls if they do this. So my manager said they will greenlight Real Housewives of Beverly Hills if you say yes right now. And I was like, right now? I need time to think about this. The whole time I was like, is this really going to happen? Am I really going to do this? And they said, well, if you say yes, it's a go. And I was like, okay, let me just call Kim. And I said, listen, we could do the E thing or we could do this. This is already an existing successful franchise. And I don't know, I kind of, in my mind, I didn't always want to be Paris Hilton's aunt or Kim Richards' sister. Growing up, I had my own acting career. Kim and I both did. And then when Paris became so famous, it was like, oh, that's Paris Hilton's aunt. And I was like, okay, if I do this E! Show with Kathy, it's going to be a lot of that. So I wanted to do my own thing. And then I brought Kim into it with me, and that's how it started. Alex Baskin. We met her at the Polo Lounge, and we just fell in love with her. I knew she was the linchpin. Next up, a pink-clad queen of hospitality and bone-dry zingers who'd established her reputation in London. Alex Baskin. Lisa Vanderpump. Douglas Ross. You mean Lisa Todd. That's who she was then. Kyle Richards. Lisa and I knew each other because she was my husband's client. I didn't know her well, but we went to business dinners and stuff like that. Lisa Vanderpump, housewife.
Sylvester Stallone's wife, Jennifer, basically said, you should watch this show called Real Housewives of New York because they're doing one in Beverly Hills. And I remember sitting on the bed watching it and I thought, oh, it seems kind of contentious. All these verbal altercations? That's something I just couldn't be part of. That's not my thing at all. It was Robert Kovacic, who was a news journalist from NBC, who got me there. He said, come on, I'm going to drive you over to the audition, let's go. It was over in the valley, and I remember he waited outside. And I didn't take it that seriously, I remember they said. Tell us about your sex life. Now I'm English. I didn't understand why on earth these people were asking about my sex life. So I joked, my sex life with my husband or with everybody else. And they laughed. I guess they liked me.
Alex Baskin. Lisa was so Beverly Hills, this extravagant, over-the-top, beautiful woman. At the time, she had the restaurants Villa Blanca and Sir, and we liked that she had businesses that sort of anchored her. Lisa Vanderpump.
I was sort of the quintessential Beverly Hills housewife. After all, I had one of the most prominent restaurants in Beverly Hills at the time, Villa Blanca, drove a white-on-white convertible Bentley, and lived in one of the premier gated communities, Beverly Park. I had always been a little eccentric, what with my love of dogs and Jiggy, my lapdog, always by my side.
Andy Cohen. Lisa Vanderpump really tipped it over for me personally as a gay man when I saw her in casting. I really responded to the fact that she was like a character out of the book Hollywood Wives. She was like a Collins sister. Jennifer Redinger. When we did her callback at her house, she was telling us interesting, fun stories. Cedric Martinez was there, and we were like, this is so Beverly Hills. You have a houseboy who's great looking, walks around looking all studly, and you've also got your husband. I remember looking at her closet and her jewelry. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is every girl's dream. Lisa really embodied glamour and aspirational living. Lisa Vanderpump.
When they came to my house and filmed some test scenes, I started to become interested. But that's also when they put the project on hold for a while. And it's funny. Often you learn what you want when someone's going to take it away from you, and I wanted it. When I finally got the call, it was quite a few months later. Ken and I were in London, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, my phone rang. Ken and I were fooling around in bed, as you do, and I saw the number and told Ken, get off, it's an 818 number, it could be them. That's how much I wanted to be part of the show.
Once Lisa and Kyle were in place, young mom Taylor Armstrong's name was thrown into the mix. Alex Baskin. Taylor represented more of a striver, the outsider in Beverly Hills, who was looking to fit in, someone who had moved to California from Oklahoma and was sort of trafficking in those circles. She didn't have the money, wasn't as established. After RHONJ had shown how complicated and explosive family dynamics could be on screen, RHOBH followed suit by extending an offer to Kim Richards, Kyle's older sister and a fellow former child star. Andy Cohen. The truth is, there would not have been a show without Kyle and Kim. I know I said I didn't want actresses, but Kyle and Kim Richards were a different type because their stardom had faded. Kim especially kept talking about how iconic she was. Dave Ruppel. I'm old enough to remember Kim Richards on Nanny and the Professor and the Disney movies. It's funny, when we were filming, she would occasionally smoke off camera. I was trying to get it on camera, and literally she looked at me like, Dave, you can't do that. I'm a Disney girl. And that really is the way she views herself, even all these years later. Jennifer Redinger. During the interviews, Kyle and Kim talked about each other, and you could tell there were things they needed to say to each other. They were telling me stories about Thanksgiving dinner and who sat where at the table. You could see there is so much love, but I was a little bit of a therapist listening to each frustration. Producers had long had their eye on Adrian Malouf, a member of the famed Casino dynasty who brought mover and shaker energy to the group. Her proximity to Lisa Vanderpump also established a frenemy vibe that any good housewife series needs. Dave Ruppel. Adrian Malouf. Her family owned the Palms Casino in Vegas and also the Sacramento Kings basketball team. Adrian Malouf, housewife. My husband Paul had heard about the show through his publicist, so he was thinking, wow, this could really help my business. But we had children, so I was initially hesitant. Alex Baskin. We had some meetings with Adrian and Paul, and it was very clear to us right away that Paul wanted to do the show much more than Adrian did. Paul had been on television, featured on Dr. 90210, and really thought that the show would be good for his practice, and was a little bit of a ham anyway. Jennifer Redinger. She and Paul were hilarious. I asked one question, and the rest of the time, they were just back and forth bickering. It was funny, it wasn't mean. I was like, oh my God, they have such a crazy fun connection. And I can see that they're going to be really interesting on the show. Sometimes you have to pull a little bit more out of the husband, but that never happened with Adrian and Paul. It was almost like he wanted to be just as fabulous. Adrian Maloof. For me, it was, okay, I'm going to go from known family to well-known all over the world. And that's kind of a scary thought. Alex Baskin. I'll never forget a meeting we had with Paul and Adrian, where Adrian was on the fence about the show. She turned to me and said, if you were me, would you do it? So I said, no, and I'd be making a mistake. Adrian Maloof. Lisa Vanderpump had also pushed for me to be on the show. Alex Baskin. Beverly Park, where Lisa and Adrian lived, is the wealthiest of the wealthy. Huge stars live there. It's one of those places where on Halloween, kids get in buses to go from house to house because the properties are so big they can't just walk the neighborhood. So the idea that we would not have one, but two cast members who live in Beverly Park really set the show apart. Andy Cohen. Vanderpump and Adrian Maloof lived across the street from each other in these, like, fiberglass castles. Dave Ruppel. One of the network's favorite gimmicks was to have them walk to each other's houses because they'd have to go out their huge yard, gates would open, they'd cross the street, other gates would open, and they'd have to go up another huge yard to get to their doorstep. Chris Cullen. Right from the beginning, it felt like they were the two alpha dogs in this game. Even as production for season one was imminent, producers still felt the puzzle wasn't quite complete. Alex Baskin. Doug and I were thinking, we are one cast member short. We need someone else. We're just not exactly sure who it is. One day, I was on the phone with Kyle, and I said, you sort of know everyone. Can you just rack your brain? Go through your Rolodex? Is there someone we're missing? And she's looking at her phone, and she got to Camille Grammer. And then she started describing having seen Camille at a party, dancing wildly. Kyle Richards. I saw her at a Christmas party. She was like dancing on a pole. Camille Grammer, housewife. I received a phone call from Kyle Richards a few days after I ran into her and Lisa Vanderpump around town. She started talking to me about this project that she had going with the network. It was a Real Housewives. My initial reaction was no. I said, Kelsey will never allow me to do this. He's never going to okay this. And she just went, oh. Well, you know, this is the time that we really need to start thinking about ourselves and not just our husbands. And Lisa and I know you'd be great. Would you think about coming in for an audition? Kyle Richards. She said, I don't know. I don't think Kelsey would want me to do something like that. And we all know what happened there. Dave Ruppel. I remember the first interview. We were talking about her life, homes, whatever. And she says, oh, you know, we have a house in Malibu, and we have 7 or 8 other houses. And she had no awareness of if she had 7 or 8, or that that would sound like an enormous amount to the average person. Alex Baskin. At the time, she was incredibly unfiltered, didn't give a shit. She had spent the past 4 years as the wife of Kelsey Grammer, the biggest star and highest paid actor on television. Camille Grammer. To be honest with you, we didn't watch the show. My mom watched it and had a lot more information than I did. She said, they will eat you alive. You're pretty naive at times, and they're going to tear you down and pick at your bones until there's nothing left. And I was like, this doesn't sound good. So I thought there was no way Kelsey would be for it. He had been really private after he went through his recovery. So when he said to me, this is a good opportunity for you, I was very surprised. Douglas Ross. I will never forget the time that Alex, Kathy French, and I went out to Camille's house in Malibu. I was thinking to myself, I can't believe it. I'm going to Kelsey Grammer's house. We sat down, and it was very friendly. But Camille kept saying she didn't know if it was right for her. And Kelsey kept pushing her, saying, oh, honey, I think it would be fun. And it was just so weird that a big star was pushing his reluctant wife to do this show. Camille Grammer. They said they were going to make it different than the other Housewives shows. More of a lifestyles of the rich and famous. And when they said that, I thought, well, you know what? That's more appealing than girls fighting. Kathleen French. I got in the car afterward and I was like, why in the world is Kelsey agreeing to do this? He was an A-level celebrity choosing to participate, and something didn't sit right with that. And I said, he's parking her. He wants out. He was on his way to do La Cage aux Folles on Broadway, and she was going to stay in California with the kids. I was like, I got a funny feeling about this. And sure enough. Alex Baskin. We found out later that Kelsey was pushing her to do the show because he had another life that he was tending to in New York. He later told Oprah that The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills was his parting gift to Camille. With season one locked and loaded, and the Housewives brand a certified success, the production values were through the roof. Dave Ruppel. The franchise and the network had gotten so big over the years, so the expectations were a lot higher. Suddenly, you're in Kelsey Grammer's home, and you're looking at all of his Emmys, and you're like, this is not like Gina Keough's house. Lisa Vanderpump. I was so unsure of what we were getting into. The first day of filming, we were going to Vegas, and they were filming us getting ready in our bathroom. Ken was packing his bag. I said, what are you doing packing four things of neatly folded underwear? You normally only wear one a week. You know, joking. And he looked at me like, are you nuts? That's going to be on television. Why would you say something like that? I just laughed, but he was like, oh shit, what have I gotten myself into? Camille Grammer. I was terrified going into filming. I had gotten that warning from my mom, and sure enough, that year I was the target. Alex Baskin. The tension started even before filming. Kathleen French. Whenever we start a season, we do a general dinner with the cast to go through the ins and outs of how the show is going to work and also have a glass of wine and get to know each other. The field producers, the showrunner, and Doug and Alex were there. Alex Baskin. Camille had called in advance to say she needed to leave early to go to a Bon Jovi concert. And as much as her leaving early would go against our plan to have everyone together the entire time for bonding, we thought, why not let her tell everyone the situation herself? We knew it would probably ruffle some feathers, but we had no idea that in addition to leaving early, she would also show up to the meeting really, really late. So we'd all been seated for at least an hour, and Camille sort of busted in and interrupted wherever we were in the conversation. She said basically, I'm sure you guys have spent a lot of time talking. Is there anything you want to know about me? So everybody was sort of already at high irritation at the beginning. Andy Cohen. I knew from the first few episodes that Camille was in for a really rough time. As a TV producer, I absolutely loved it, obviously, and found it wildly entertaining. She was outspoken in a really polarizing way. Dave Ruppel. Tensions heated up when we were coming back from a quick trip to Vegas. I made a decision we weren't going to shoot the trip home as sort of a reward to the cast and crew. And so Camille and Kyle and Kim were waiting for their cars. And they were the only people there. There were no other witnesses. Some holiday was coming up, and Kyle asked Camille, what do you have planned? And Camille said, I'm going to Hawaii and the crew is coming with me. Camille Grammer. I remember Kyle being disappointed at production for filming me in Hawaii without Kelsey there. Kyle Richards. What I said to her off camera was, what are you going to do for spring break? And she said, they're filming me in Hawaii. And I said, oh, they're filming you? Is Kelsey going too? She said, no. And I said, oh, really? Because I didn't know how it worked. It was our first trip. We had just started. But she said, oh, you don't think I'm interesting enough without Kelsey? They wouldn't want to film me? And I was like, what are you talking about? Dave Ruppel. The point of contention became whether or not Kyle said, "The crew's coming with you without Kelsey?" In Kyle's mind, she was saying, "I'm surprised you're going without Kelsey." In Camille's mind, she heard, "Why would the cameras shoot you if Kelsey's not there?" Camille Grammer. I felt that she was pressing a little too much, and it made me feel uncomfortable. Dave Ruppel. It played into Camille's insecurity of always being overlooked because she had a very famous husband. Kyle Richards.
I literally just didn't know that we could go on spring break. If we got a spring break, if they filmed with us, it was all new to me. But then when I said, "Don't be insecure," that sent her over the edge.
Camille Grammer. I was excited about my trip to Hawaii, still thinking the show was supposed to be like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. I wasn't thinking about whether my husband would be there. I felt like her line of questioning was backing me into a corner. So that's when I said, "Obviously you're not happy with this, and I don't like your attitude about it." And then the fight started. Dave Ruppel. I know Andy Cohen hates the fact that that was off camera, but to me, it's genius. It would have been much less interesting if we had seen exactly what was said. That mystery drove a whole season of tension. Andy Cohen. I was also annoyed that it was a fight that broke the fourth wall. It was about cameras. What I didn't realize then was that fourth wall breaking fights would become pretty common on RHOBH. Camille Grammer. She apologized at one point, but she didn't really. It was more like, "You don't have to be so insecure. What kind of apology is that?" Tensions continued to build during another girls' trip, this time to New York City. It all started at dinner on the first night. Dave Ruppel. Camille had gone to the bathroom with Taylor. They went in very calmly. Camille Grammer. Taylor was telling me what the girls were saying about me at the airport before they flew to New York. It wasn't nice. Dave Ruppel. About 5 minutes later, the door flew open and Camille was just red-hot angry. Camille Grammer. I was very, very upset that I had become the target, the butt of the joke. I think some of the girls knew more about how these shows work. I know Kyle was very close to Bethany Frankel, but I was so green and I was learning under fire. So I said, "You're not doing this to me. You're not going to make me look like the bad guy." When Kyle started yelling at me, I was just shocked. Dave Ruppel. The next morning, we had an early morning shoot between Lisa Vanderpump and Kyle. They were laughing about how ridiculous the previous night had gotten. And Lisa said, "I feel like I've been shagged through a hedge backward." Even though it had been chaos hours before, they were having so much fun. And that's what I loved about the show. They could fight and recover. I've always said that women are sort of like steel magnolias. They can be the best of friends or the worst friends, and then they bounce back. Camille Grammer. Even today, I still think I'm in the right, and I'm sure Kyle still thinks she's in the right. That will never get resolved. Camille's relationship with Kyle and the women went up in yet more smoke later in the season when she offered to host a night fueled by strong cocktails and shocking predictions. Alex Baskin. Camille had been pitching doing a dinner party and having Allison Dubois give readings. Allison was a good friend of Camille and Kelsey, and she was the basis for Medium, the show produced by Kelsey's company, Gramnet Productions. She was saying to us, "She's great, and if you get a couple of drinks in her, she's even better." Camille Grammer. She was hesitant, but I said, "We can talk about Medium and promote it. Kelsey thinks it's good publicity." Dave Ruppel. We went into that dinner not thinking Allison would give us much. If anything, we were expecting Kyle to start something because she insisted on bringing Faye Resnick. She came with a wingman. Kyle Richards. Going there, I knew Camille was going to be coming after me. She just had that cat with the canary look on her face all the time. She felt I brought Faye as my wingman, but that's not why she was there. Camille was just nervous that I had someone in from the outside who would see what she was doing. Camille Grammer. Faye wasn't very nice to me when she showed up at my house that night. She was just snarky and acting like a high school catty girl, even though she was an adult. That immediately put me on the defensive. But it was really at the very end of the night that the fireworks happened. Dave Ruppel. We were almost done shooting. There had been very little contention. They literally were like 5 minutes away from having had a nice dinner party. I think we already started wrapping one crew, and then that's when it all kicked off. Camille Grammer. All the girls had been drinking these very large cocktails, and Allison wasn't eating any dinner. She got feisty because they were asking her to give them readings, and she just wanted to support me. She finally said, "I'm not here to be anybody's show pony." By the end of the night, Allison's plan to be off the clock went down the tubes, cementing the dinner party from hell in Housewives history. Chris Cullen. Allison had a mouth, and Faye has a mouth, so they both went in and did some of the heavy lifting for our cast members. Camille Grammer. The other girls weren't innocent that night either. They came after us pretty hard, but Allison did say those things. Kathleen French. From the viewer's standpoint, people felt Camille had a hand in Allison going after Kyle, and it certainly looked like that to me, too. Andy Cohen. I remember watching that for the first time, and I was in a state of euphoria. Kyle Richards. I found it entertaining myself, even in the moment. I had never seen an e-cigarette before, because they were new at the time. I was like, what on God's green earth is that? But she just looks so evil. Camille Grammer. Allison said to me, "These are not your friends. You know, they'll kill their own. This is about the business and making money. They're not even each other's friends. They're just backstabbing. Don't trust them." But she was devastated by how the night turned out. She thought I threw her under the bus. Andy Cohen. The thing that pushed it all the way over the top, besides the e-cigarette, was the women getting drunk.